historic in an unprecedented
move. Controversial move. The center has notified new land laws for Jammu and Kashmir and for Ladakh.
The Narendra Modi government today scrapped the Article 370, which gives special status to Jammu and Kashmir.
Hello and welcome to News from a Boring Dystopia. For today's episode, we discuss the ongoing conflict in Kashmir, as well as its history. Joining us is Fahad Shah, a renowned Kashmiri journalist, editor-in-chief of at the Kashmir Walla. He is a writer for Time, The Atlantic, Foreign Affairs, The Guardian, and Foreign Policy. Welcoming Fahad.
Well, I'm a journalist and I have been working in Kashmir for the last 11 years. I started journalism and working as a journalist in 2009, and I started the Kashmir Walla in 2011 when I was in college. And the aim to start this publication was mainly because it came out as, like, you know, in 2008 we had a civil uprising in Kashmir, and during that time, after that, I went to Delhi and I felt that, you know, people really don't know about Kashmir, what we just had. You know, 80 civilians got killed on the streets and people in Delhi were like, oh, really, what happened in Kashmir? And I was like, media is not representing Kashmir in the way that it should represent Kashmir. So why don't we have something of our own? And that's how the beginning of the Kashmir Walla started, and now it has been continuing. And for the last 2 years, we have an office and we have like a staff of over 12 people working from Srinagar newsroom. And I have been writing for other publications also, mainly outside India, because I see that the media in India has rapidly changed, and there's a lot of censorship when it comes to Kashmir. That's why I prefer to write outside India. And in the recent few years, I think this whole decade has been really volatile in Kashmir, with the rising militancy, the government, you know, like falling apart, and then BJP coming to power as a coalition government, and more young people joining militancy and the protesters also. So this whole decade of my journalism has been that only. That's what I have been covering mainly, the human rights violations, and my focus is mainly on the militancy in Kashmir and the political situation. And right now, I'm sure you guys know how things are. Like, you know, since last August, we have been dealing with a different Kashmir now. It's not the same Kashmir that we used to have, even though that Kashmir was also bad, but this one is entirely different now.
Their rejoicing at the cutting of the Maharaja's oppressive powers is tempered by the realization that Kashmir is the stumbling block to peace between India, represented here by Prime Minister Pandit Nehru, and Pakistan, who sent no representative.
Since then, the region has faced violent struggles. Both India and Pakistan have fought over the territory. Kashmiris have struggled for the promised plebiscite, and India's hold over the region has only grown in a brutal way. Nevertheless, as a privileged non-Kashmiri student who moved out of the country in 2019, I cannot speak truth to this current situation. This is why we have Fahad Shah with us today.
Well, you know, it started from, I think, before 5th of August, like, you know, the week before 5th of August, there were these, instantly these orders started coming out from the government that, you know, hospitals should have enough number of staff available, they should have all the resources, people should go and they should have all the ration from the depots. The petrol pumps were, you know, like entirely filled, and people were just lining up at the petrol pumps with these orders. And just 3 days before 5th of August, tourists were told to leave Kashmir because apparently the government at that point of time said that this is for the security reasons, because there's a threat of an attack or something. And that's why the tourists and even the yatris, the pilgrims who come to Kashmir, were told to leave. And we didn't know what was happening. I'll tell you honestly that in my own newsroom, my staff asked me, they were like, you know, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, like, I had a little bit of, you know, like the input that I said that perhaps they are going to do the trifurcation of J&K. They're going to separate Jammu and Kashmir and Ladakh in three different regions, or they're going to go to war with Pakistan or whatever, in like some strike or something. That was the apprehension. But on 4th of August, and I think around evening, I met someone in Kashmir, and he said that tomorrow they are going to take away Article 370 and 35A. And that's when I was like, okay, that's happening now. And but still, we didn't know what was going to come next. We had no idea that how much of the restrictions and the communication blockade they are going to impose. We thought that, you know, it's going to be like 2016 or 2010, that at least something will be working. But around late on 4th of August, all these politicians, they started detaining them. Former chief ministers were starting detained like around 11:30 p.m. And that's when I realized that things are going to get really bad. You know, if they are detaining former chief ministers, that means that this is something much bigger. And then I remember that when the internet went down around 1:30 a.m. or something, and we were all awake, and around 2:30 I left from my home and I went to office, and I told two of my colleagues that they should reach to office because internet is going to go away and we can only have a corporate line, the office internet. But we had no idea that we were going to lose that also. So we went to office at 3 a.m. and we started, we were writing, you know, like updates, just whatever was happening in the news. And then I think around 4:30 or 5, we published an editorial saying that, you know, New Delhi should consider about people, and it's not about land only in Kashmir. There are people also living. And then we thought, you know, we'll rest for a day, for an hour or something. And we slept, we fell asleep because we were tired throughout the day. And when we woke up and there was no internet, everything was shut, you know, our cell phones were gone, the office internet was gone, which is a corporate lease line, that was shut. And I think around 11, we didn't know what had happened. But at 11, when nothing was, you know, there were other few people in the staff who came, and I told one of my colleagues that let's go outside and let's see what's happening outside. And then we went outside, and there was a shopkeeper who was screaming on the road, and he was like crying, and he was screaming, and he was like, they took it away, and they divided us and whatever, you know, like they just took it away. Everything has changed. And we asked him, why did you see this? He said, I saw it on the television, because he had the dish TV, because the cable television was also shut. Then we went to the main city center, Lal Chowk, and we saw that, you know, we thought we'll just go and we'll see what is happening in the city center. And we saw that everything was shut. There was enormous number of forces, the government forces on the street. I, in my whole career and my whole life, have never seen such a curfew and restriction ever. It was the worst curfew that was ever imposed in Kashmir. And there was nothing on the street other than the government forces. Nothing at all, not even, you know, like the health workers or anything at all. It was just us, and after every 100 or 200 meters we were stopped that where are you going. And literally the situation was such that I think a few days later, when I started coming for 3 days after 5th of August, I didn't go home. I was just working, because I was going to hospital and stuff like that, and it was impossible to go to hospital also, because What they did was that they put up security barricades just outside the hospital, not to allow anyone inside, because they didn't want people to see if they were injured or something. That's why the security barricades were put up. But then we went in like past midnight and met some of the people who were injured in some protests. But days after that, when we would come out of our house and we had to go to office or the city center, not office, mainly the city center, the forces would tell us, you know, like very openly that why are you going out? You know, media has no job here anymore. Where are you going? The offices are shut. The newspapers are shut. This is now New Kashmir. You shouldn't be like, you know, venturing out. And I remember I was told myself several times that, you know, if you guys talk too much, now you will be taken to Tihar jail, which is a prison in Delhi. This is not the same Kashmir anymore. And that's what happened for several weeks. I think for next 3 months, that was the situation. And then journalists did not have any access to internet or any phone for a long time, until the government set up this internet center, and where everything was monitored, and we had to work there and wait in the queue. So basically, the first few weeks, what we did in that 1 or 2 weeks was that we sent pen drives, thumb drives to airport. We went to airport and gave it to passengers and told them, you know, can you take this to Delhi and can you just mail it to this person or can you give it to this person? You will meet that person. And that's how the first content went out of Kashmir in the beginning days until there was that garment service. That was the situation, and the situation was also such that, you know, when I was out of home, I wouldn't know what was going in my home, in my area. And my area where I come from was the area where you must have seen those protests and large protests and barricades. That's where I live. I live inside those barricaded area. So our area was barricaded by people for like 3 months. They didn't allow police to enter that area and they were protesting inside. And I had no idea what was happening. I remember that one time I was at the airport doing the same thing, you know, giving my story to someone or trying to find out internet. And someone said there's a huge protest, like, you know, 75 people have been killed and this and that. But I had no access to call my family and, you know, confirm whether they're fine or not until I went home at night, and then I was like, okay, they're fine. That was the situation for everyone. We traveled to hostels. We saw, like, you know, there were people in the hostels who had left home 3 days ago and they had no idea about what was going at their home, and their family had no idea what was happening at the hostel. In the first few days, I met some of these people, you know, who were at the hostel to deliver babies because they were pregnant. And they said that, you know, our families don't know that, you know, whether I had a son or baby or whatever, what has happened to me. They have no idea what is going on. And that was the situation. And this situation, we have never seen such a situation in Kashmir ever before.
So throughout this, the government maintained that no one has died or there hasn't been any violence. And can you tell us more about if the protests were violent, if how many people do you think died or were injured? What was the situation like?
Well, you know, there were, I think, 2 or 3, 4 people died, and there were protesters in several parts. There were protesters mainly in this particular area, which was barricaded. There was a huge, you know, like this procession that came out, I think, around somewhere in August, which the government vehemently denied that it didn't happen when BBC and Reuters reported. But I live in that area, so I know it happened. A lot of people witnessed it and saw, like, you know, thousands of people marching on the streets, but the government denied it. But then the videos came out and stuff like that. You also have to understand that there was no mechanism to talk to government. You know, like, as journalists, we are told that you need to verify and you need to get the government version on any story that you will do. But the situation was that even if you couldn't call officials, but even if there was a press conference and the government spokesperson would come to give the press briefing, you were asking questions and that was, you know, the person was like, no, this didn't happen. You would probably come from that particular spot or the situation or the protest, and you would tell that spokesperson that, you know, this is what I saw right now, just 2 hours ago. I remember when the government gave statements that the schools are opening and, you know, everything is functional, children are going to school. There was this one journalist who got up and told the government, you know, where are these children? Because we just went to every school, we can't see anyone. There are not even buses moving on the street. So how are people going to school? But there was nothing. So there was, you know, continuous denial for several months until the phone starts working. And I think it was not just, you know, happening right there. I think all of this was a proper plan. This was a strategic plan that this is how things are going to be. Cable will be cut, phones will be cut, internet will be down. And then one by one, this is how it will happen. For a few months, there will be no internet. Then we'll release this and we'll start this. And it was a strategic plan that the government had made. And I think to a lot of extent, it worked, because you wouldn't really know what was happening just 10 kilometers away in Kashmir. You had just knowledge. And I think that we as journalists, what we did was that we have this press club in the city center. So every day we used to come there. We used to reach there early in the morning, and then there you would meet journalists from other areas, and they would tell you, okay, this is how my area was, this is what happened in our area, this is what I heard. So basically a lot of things were just rumors and rumors. So till the time you would prove whether this rumor is true or false, it would be like days. I did one story for which I had to go like 100 kilometers away from the city, which is from Srinagar. We did this story because I heard someone telling me that, oh, there is this one person who has committed suicide in a jail in Uttar Pradesh. And I was like, you know, probably I should check what has happened. And when I went to that place, which is in north of Kashmir, 100 kilometers from the Sama capital, I found out that that person had died in a local police station, in the local jail. And people had no idea in Srinagar what had happened. And his family claimed that he was beaten up and killed while he was in detention. But the police said that he had committed suicide. And that was the situation. And there was very less, distribution of news, newspapers. We ourselves have a weekly newspaper. We could not print it for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, we started printing it. Our website was down for at least 5 to 7 months. In between, there's this interesting thing which can highlight the magnanimity of the crackdown that was happening, that when the government started this internet service center for the journalists, and I went there and I realized there that, you know, I can't access my Gmail because my Gmail has two-factor the authentication, but I couldn't access my phone. So for that particular thing, I had to go to Delhi to change my password for my email, and then I had to come back. And I could use it. And that was the situation. And for the photojournalists and the video journalists, if you have to send the footage, it would take long time. It would take days to send 10 GB or 5 GB footage. A lot of them had to go to Delhi, and then they could only file their stories. So it was a very difficult period for journalists to file stories, and for people also, because people had no idea. Even though we as journalists had some idea that something was happening, general people and the civilian population, they had no idea what was happening. They just had rumors and whispers, that's all.
I remember writing about this back in December of last year, December of 2019, when I was still at university, and I was writing about it more from the nuclear weapons perspective, and the different doctrines. But I remember distinctly in February coming into work and seeing the Balakot airstrike on the newspaper, and thinking to myself, this is going to really escalate, because you had the suicide bombing on February 14th, then you had the Balakot airstrike, and it's all culminated in the revocation of Article 370, which has just led to what you were just telling us. What you've had in the past with other crises, such as the Twin Peak crisis and the Kargil crisis, you've had an interesting reaction from Pakistan, to the extent that the US has had to get involved. But now you've seen kind of a reverse. This time it's been the aggressor in a way. It's India more than Pakistan has been in the past. So I just wanted to ask you how the Imran Khan and the Modi policy kind of compare to the previous ones. And I also wanted to ask you about the issue of identity in Kashmir in comparison to what's currently going on in Nagorno-Karabakh and the Republic of Aksar. So those are the two main things I wanted to ask you about, the foreign policy and the issue of identity in Kashmir.
Well, I think in the beginning, when things started happening, people in Kashmir had, they were expecting that Pakistan is going to do something, there's going to be a lot of stuff that will be, there will be a huge response from the Imran Khan administration. But I think after a few weeks, it was clear that there wasn't much happening other than the fact that, they were talking a lot and they were talking to other people and they were giving a lot of statements. And I think by September, Imran Khan was speaking at the UN. That was much about it. That was all that was happening from Pakistan. But I believe that even if this was this would have been the previous government in Pakistan, I think it would have been same. You know, like there wouldn't have been much happening from Pakistan, because what else, you know, like Pakistan would have done? What would have you expected, that, you know, they could go to war and, you know, they could fly their jets or something else? That had happened just a few months ago when Balakot happened. But people did have a lot of expectations that time from Pakistan. They thought that something big is going to happen, but it did not happen. And I think after September, by the time we were in October, it was quite clear that not much is going to happen, and other than the fact that they're going to have like some diplomatic pressure on something, there isn't going to be much happening from Pakistan. And it was also clear that, you know, there were a lot of statements coming from several world bodies, whether it was the State Department of the US or other bodies in the world, you know, like human rights groups, that there are human rights violations, that internet should be restored and people should be allowed to move out freely. But nothing of that really worked, because if we look at today, it has been more than 1 year. Even today, Kashmir, most Kashmir does not have high-speed internet. It is still low-speed internet. The high-speed internet is still banned. So all of that did not work. And to the other question of the identity, that's an interesting question, because that's what is the major topic right now. Because in the last 1 year, there are two major things that have happened after this abrogation. One is that the permanent resident ship, you know, like there was a kind of a special citizenship people in Jammu and Kashmir, that they had special rights on their land, on their jobs and other things. But now that has been changed. They have brought in a new rule called domicile rule. It has been changed. And anybody who has lived in Kashmir for 15 to 10 years can become a domicile, can apply, and that will eventually change the population dynamics in terms of religion, you know, like Hindu and Muslim, because considering it's a Muslim majority region. And this happened in April 2020. And the other thing that was recently done last month was that the land laws were changed. Earlier, nobody from outside Jammu and Kashmir could buy land in Kashmir or own a property in Kashmir. But now with those land laws changed, anyone can buy land and property in Kashmir. And also, interestingly, what is pointed out in that, in those laws, is that the army, the forces, the government forces, the troops, can declare any particular area as a strategic area, and government will facilitate them that land. So tomorrow, a particular area can be, the army can say, you know, we want this portion of land, and the government will facilitate and give it to them. So that particular land will be occupied, and there will be a camp and training center and residential colonies and stuff like that. And I think what people were feeling threatened about in August, when this decision happened, was the demographic change, you know, that there will be inflow of people from outside, that our own identity and culture will slowly degrade and will be changed and turned into something else. And that is what is happening with those two things, domicile and land laws, that it is slowly changing. And it's already in process, you know, like these things are already happening. The other main factor for all of this success is that the administration, you know, the bureaucracy in J&K, it's all non-Kashmiris. Most of the people in the higher positions in the decision-making body of J&K, while they are taking decisions about the people of Kashmir, are not from Kashmir. They are from outside. They are from different regions. And they have been brought in slowly and slowly. And they are holding charges of everything. So industries, you know, is given, handed over a particular piece of land, and then they will hand over to something else. So people fear that, you know, tomorrow there are going to be big corporates who are going to take over the orchards, who are going to take over the farmland, who are going to take over other stuff. And slowly this unique identity of Kashmir and Jammu and Kashmir and other smaller identities that are in this region are going to vanish, and it's going to be just one of the states like in other parts of India. That's what will happen. So there is a lot of talk about identity right now, and that's what people are fearful about, that this is going to change, and then our identity will be just, you know, distracted and distributed in several parts, and maybe, you know, like, you know, we'll just become like diaspora in our own land.
I think one of the things that comes up whenever we talk about the Kashmir conflict is the presence of a lot of militants and a lot of insurgent groups. Why do people join these groups? What are, you know, there are different motives, but can you talk a little bit about the different groups that exist in the region?
You know, there are several groups that exist in Kashmir, and definitely most of them are, like, all of them are backed by Pakistan. That's clear, because there are foreign militants also in these groups. There's Hizbul Mujahideen, there is Lashkar Toiba, there is Jaish, and there are other groups also. But Hizb has mainly been a local recruit. But the critical point that has happened in the last one decade is that since post-2010 uprising, which is the time when Burhan Wani joined, who was the militant commander who was killed in 2016, is this, you know, like, this whole militancy has, you know, become a glorified thing. It has become a big thing now, you know, like, there are militants who had funerals, like 30,000 people would attend the funeral. There are young people joining again and again militancy. And that was the case in the last few years. But with the August decision, the government argued that we are doing this because this will help us bring peace and development to Kashmir. Militancy will be over and stuff like that. But interestingly, in the last 1 year, there are more and more people joining militancy. And I think there are approximated numbers that this year, 2020, could have the highest number of new recruits in the militancy, which is the outcome of the policies and the decisions that are being taken. And, you know, one also gets surprised, you know, like, gets shocked, like, why would a 22-year-old or 25-year-old, somebody who is studying in a university, just leave everything and join militancy? And I think there are different reasons for that. One is definitely that the religion gives you the space to fight when there is injustice. The other is that most of these people have faced some kind of humiliation, or most of these people have been either arrested, they had been arrested in particular cases, or they have faced high-handedness of the authorities in one way or the other. And then they feel that, you know, this life is nothing. They don't find meaning in life, they find meaning in death then. And this is what is happening. And I think just today also, there were people killed. Every week, there are gunfights and there are people getting killed. I think this belief, this idea that these particular constitutional or the decisions being made about development or stuff like that will not really end the conflict in Kashmir. And it has never ended. It has been tried again and again in the last so many decades, but it hasn't happened. The militancy has not ended. The violence has not come down. There has to be, you know, a political process. When you are jailing every political party, you are even putting jailing and slapping public safety act on the former chief ministers, the people who have been fighting in the name of India in Kashmir, then people are like, you know, this is what we told you. You have been with them for 6 years. Look what they did to you. They put you in jail. Then why are you doing this? And that is the thing, you know, like, it's like vindication of the fact that whatever you do for New Delhi, it is not going to work. You need to be basically under them. That thing. And that's why the people are joining militancy, for the humiliation of it. Yes, there is a major question that I think everybody in the world is asking. Why haven't Kashmiris come out and protested, you know, like they did in 2016 and 2010? Which is an obvious question. But the fact for that is also that a lot of people were jailed. You know, a lot of people were put in detention. A lot of people were slapped with public safety act, and their families did not know where they were for like almost 2 months. They didn't know where they were. While they were taken away from Srinagar and put in several jails in several states of India. And I think now most of these people have been released, but there are still a lot of people who are in prison. So that's why there weren't many protests. And also, in the last few months, it has been the hardest place to work in as a journalist. Like, we have faced so much for the work that we are doing, because the Kashmir Wala is an independent publication, and we have been continuously writing on the issues. And I think in the last 6 months, I have been summoned and interrogated by police 2 times, and I have been detained 1 time. Just, I think 3 weeks ago, I was detained from the national highway. You know, I was brought down from my car and taken to a police station. I was taken away for 4.5 hours. I was questioned. That's the situation. There are unlawful. There are terror cases slapped on journalists. There are newspaper offices being raided by the authorities. There are human rights activists being raided. While there is so much threat and there is so much happening, there is silence also from people. You know, there is self-censorship among the media. There's self-censorship in the people also, that, you know, if we say something, we are going to be picked up, we are going to be jailed. You know, I'll tell you honestly, I am being told by a lot of friends that, you know, why are you guys, you know, like, you guys should take a break, you know, like, go slow and stuff like that. But I'm like, you know, what are we writing? We're not writing anything that's not happening. Whatever is happening, that's what we are writing. But there are a lot of people who come to me every week, you know, like, they're like, you guys should just, you know, stop, you know, look around what is happening. Why are you guys doing this? And that is the situation. There is a lot of fear among people from every aspect.
I just wanted to ask a follow-up question then. Obviously, what you're saying is very true, is very hard, and I think it's very difficult to digest for some of us, particularly, thankfully, because some of us have not have to deal with that in our time. What was very interesting to me when I wrote about this was the role of the international community in all the Jammu and Kashmir conflicts and issues. Obviously, in the past, I mean, living in Britain, we're the first ones to have to take the blame for it. But my question is, in the past, there's been interventions by the international community in different ways, particularly going back to the role of the United States. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we spoke about it on the podcast as how is the US going to change under Joe Biden, and whether the US is going to get more involved with issues outside. But I think my general question is, what do you reckon is the role of the international community? Do they have a role to play? Is there anything that they can do? And if not, what do you see as happening for Kashmir forwards? Do you see them staying within India, or do you see them breaking away from India?
Well, you know, I think the first thing that all of us can talk about is the civil rights. You know, like, there are rights being humiliated. That's what I think. That's where the international community comes in. You know, like, not having internet. You know, people being detained and jailed for no reason. There are arbitrary arrest detentions. There are a lot of things happening with the people. There are human rights violations, and I think that's the very basic thing that where the international community comes in. And I believe, or this is my understanding, a lot of people's understanding, then when phones were restored after 3 months in Kashmir, this was probably because the United States was continuously talking about it. They were again and again talking about it. There was a hearing also in US. There were a lot of people in US trying to get the lawmakers to talk about it and say that, you know, people are being detained and stuff like that. And I think due to that, there was some partial internet restoration and phones were restored. But I think the international community, after a point, takes a backseat when it comes to things like human rights violations. I don't believe that, you know, like, this is a time where international community can really intervene and be like, okay, this is what we want, a solution to Kashmir, which is what something like Trump said, that, you know, I can be a mediator and stuff like that. It is not. We also have to accept the reality that the current government in India is a majority government. They have the majority house. they are very popular. They have people's support because wherever you go, they are getting support. You know, let's not make fool of ourselves. Everything, everybody is against them. There are a lot of people with this government and they are supporting them. So at that point of time, when you have a powerful government of people of 1.4 billion people, you don't really take advices from other countries. And that's what we have seen, that this government does not really take other countries seriously. So at that point of time, the only thing that the international community can do is maybe perhaps make life easier for the people who are going through all of this. That is that's one thing. And the other thing is that what you say, like, you know, under Joe Biden, I think people in Kashmir are really happy that there has been a regime change in US, because with the Republicans, it has been seen that they don't value human rights and all that stuff much. But with Joe Biden, and they have already spoken about Kashmir. And if you even go right now on their website and the plan in their manifesto, what they said, they have categorically mentioned that we want rights in Kashmir and people should not be detained and internet should be restored and all of stuff, which is something that they said before also when we were going through this clampdown. And I think that's the expectation that people have, that they will stand by what they said. People in Kashmir do not have the expectation, and no, they'll go entirely in war with India, because we also have to see that there are economic interests. Nation states do not work like that, even if it is like China or US or anything else. But I think even when you are living under the conflict, there are certain things that you should have access to. You know, the simple thing in a democracy, you should be able to express your dissent to a decision, but that's not happening. And that's where the international community can bring in and say, like, you know, if there is a democracy, this is what you have to do. You need to allow people to protest peacefully. You need to allow them to write. You need to allow them to speak openly about things that they don't agree with, and they should not be persecuted for that.
I know you have been detained previously, and the police forces in Kashmir have also been criticized a lot for their brutality. So can you tell us more about what it was like to be detained by the, you know, the forces? What went on, if you can share? Obviously this is personal, so you don't have to. And do you think they are there to protect, or what is their role in Kashmir?
This is my second detention in the last few years. I was detained before also for 8 hours, and I was interrogated for the same thing. And this time it was a little shocking, because I was not expecting it, because I was traveling in my own car from outside the state. And, you know, there's this saying that at the end of the tunnel, there is the light. And when you come to Kashmir by road, there is this mountain pass that you have to go through the tunnel, which is like 1.6 kilometers long. And so I enter this tunnel, and my phone goes off, there's no network. And when I come out of the tunnel, literally, my car is stopped, and I'm told to get down. And I get down, and, you know, like, they saw my I-card, and they said, the guy who saw my ID, he told the other officials that this is him. And the moment he said this is him, armed personnel who came around and, you know, like, just surrounded the car, and they thought, you know, like, we just caught someone big. And I was surprised, you know, I was shocked, because I was driving for 8 hours and I just entered the tunnel and I come out and this is what happens. And then I told the officer, I said, what's happening? You know, like, I'm not a criminal. Why are you treating me like this? And they started frisking everything, you know, my shoes and everything, my car. And they were like, you know, just stay away from your car. And it was me and my colleague, and but this officer was like, you know, he looked like from somewhere from South India, and he was like educated. I thought he might understand, and I was like telling him, you know, I'm a journalist, why are you doing this? You know, if you want to verify, you can call this person and you can check. I'm a journalist, you shouldn't do this. And he kept us waiting, and we were there, and while he called and stuff like that, then he told them, bring the vehicle, and they were going to take us in that vehicle. But I objected. I said, I'm not a criminal, so I'm not going to go into a police vehicle like this. I'll go in my own car. Then they kept two gunmen in my car, and a driver also. He told them to drive, and we were taken to police station around 6 to 6:30 in the evening. So, but my family had no knowledge, because the first thing they did was took away our phone and put them, just switched them off. He asked me password and dialed some numbers and switched it off. So my family had no idea where we were. Then for the next 4 hours, I was questioned by other senior officer in the police station. I was asked a lot of things, you know, like, what are you doing? What do you write when the gunfight happens? What are you writing about militants? What have you written this time? What is your ideology? Are you affiliated with a political party and stuff like that? So that went on. And interestingly and luckily, there was someone in the police station who recognized me, and he told someone outside that he has been brought here. And that's how my friends and my people, my colleagues, got to know that I am in a police station. Otherwise, nobody would have known that I was there for like 4 hours, 4.5 hours. And then I left, then they let me go at around 10:30, 11 in the night. And then I reached home, and that's a continuous thing. Like, you know, they keep questioning you, they keep asking you stuff like that. These are like the official things that happen. But then there are unofficial things that happen, that, you know, you do a story, you get a call, oh, why are you doing this stuff? You know, why are you publishing all this? Why are you doing all of this stuff? And there is this continuous threat. And Kashmir is a place where you don't know where the threat comes from, where you don't know what you're publishing, who is liking it, because there are so many actors playing in this conflict that you literally have no idea, you know, the person you're talking to, who that person is. It's very confusing, and it's mentally traumatic.
Is there a particular narrative you think they want to be reported, and do they have their own groups that do this for them, or is it simply just trying to shut down public dissemination of you know, what personal experiences and the newspapers themselves?
Well, absolutely, they want to post you know, their own narrative, and definitely they have their own teams. You know, like, there are a lot of people who report entirely different stuff. I'll tell you an incident that after August, we had the Eid. The Eid was coming around just, I think, a week or something after 5th of August. And on the day of the Eid, you would know that the Muslims go to these congregational prayers in the morning. And But on that Eid, there were like, nobody went to any prayers because everything was shut. We couldn't. Then there was media on television in India was showing that, you know, oh, people are celebrating, they're outside. So they had gathered, you know, a bunch of people somewhere, and the camera was there, and the reporter was shooting near the Dal Lake, and were like, you know, everything is normal in Kashmir. You know, these children are saying they're good, they're happy. And that's what is being shown. And I think a lot of damage that has been done to the reality is because of the media, and mainly because of the news channels in India. I'm sure if you will watch them, you will have a headache in 5 minutes. The way they are doing things, you know, the way they are reporting, it's not journalism, it's entirely different. You know, I'll tell you this recent thing, just 2 days ago, there's this one news channel in India which is very popular, Aajtak. They had this debate on debate or something with the Prime Minister, and the title of the debate was India's Father in Hindi, like India. That's the kind of journalism they do. That's the kind of work they do. So when there are these other journalists like us, we are reporting. So if you go, like, you know, on Twitter, if you use my Twitter account, you will see what happens when we write or when we post. When I tweet, there's like the barrage of people come in and they start abusing, and they're like, oh, these terrorists, these liars, these stuff, these propagandists, what are you doing? And stuff like that. And that puts your life under danger, because, you know, they are just pointing you out. like sometimes they put your photograph out there and they post a thread and they do stuff like that. I'll tell you literally, when I come to Delhi or when I come to out of Kashmir now, and after like last year, August, I don't really go out. I don't go out anymore without anyone having it with me. I don't travel openly. I go in a cab and I don't go in markets. I don't go in places where, you know, I'm like, I recognize me from somewhere and it will be dangerous because people have been lynched in a lot of places. You never know what happens here. That's the level of fear that we have. And I think earlier it was just with the news channels in India, but now it's happening with newspapers. And interestingly, now it's happening with the websites also, who call themselves independent news websites. They have these pieces which are very tragic and which is entirely something else that they do. And that's why I think it's very important for us to sustain. That's why we are continuously working, because we think that what we are writing and what we are publishing is important. For I don't know how long we can continue this, how long we can sustain this, that we don't know. But till the time we are able to do it, we will continue it, because we are basically making the archive of things and it will be out there whatever long we are going to be able to do it. That it's a, I think communication blockade was done in August was basically a information war. That's why the government was so, you know, so much against it, so much, you know, like choking the space, that they did not want things to come out. Whatever was happening, even if there were no protests, they didn't want people's opinions and views to come out. And there are a lot of people who have been told in person or who have been called and told, you know, not to write and stuff. I would tell you there are a lot of journalists whose newspapers are not allowing them to write on Kashmir, even though they're Kashmiris, but the newspapers are not firing them, but they're not letting them write also. And they are, these people are very senior people.
So I have kind of a question here and then the comments. So the question is that, so you talk about if you were to post something, then you would see a lot of slander basically occur on something like tweet post saying, you know, this guy's lying and this is not the truth. What about their side? On a public platform, like something like Twitter, where it's not managed by the country and it's not just, you know, government controlled, do you see an effort to take that down? And then, you know, is there any support from Twitter or these organizations for Kashmir in this sense? And then the comment I was going to say is simply just that we could help you. Obviously, I think it's good. I think so. This goes into disinformation and misinformation, which hopefully will improve after the Trump administration. But it's a common thing everywhere. And there's many people working on AI, machine learning techniques to identify these things. However, it is such a hard problem that we are still at the point of having to vouch for each other. And so if there's anything that we can do to help your effort, that would be, we can try.
Yeah, well, you know, like, it is interesting because Facebook has really been the pro government, because I think what they do is mostly they take down the profiles of the Kashmiris. Twitter is, there are a lot of these people out there, you know, like, so I have received notices several times over my tweets that people have reported and, you know, said that, you know, this is wrong, but those tweets are like news, the reality, but people keep on tweeting. I have tried to report a lot of these tweets, and sometimes, yes, the tweets are taken down or the accounts are suspended when they are found that they are wrongly. Like just recently, I think a week or two ago, someone posted a whole thread on me, accusing me of, you know, like being a terrorist and stuff like that, and put my picture and put information out there. And I reported that tweet, and I told a lot of my friends to do it. A lot of people posted on Twitter that, you know, we should report this account. But that account is still there. It has not been taken down, even though it was clearly threatening, and even though that person was openly calling for violence and saying, you know, like, we should attack this person. but the Twitter did not take it down. And I think what they're doing with Trump is mainly because, you know, it's also a PR stunt to do. But that's not the same thing that happens with common people, because there are a lot of fake accounts that are running in India that I think you can just see that these are fake accounts. That's how the narratives are being created. That's how the trends are being created, because of the fake account. And there's a lot of social media surveillance in Kashmir also. There are a lot of people who have been called or questioned or detained over social media posts, or they have been told to use social media, the proper comments on social media. And that's why there's a lot of surveillance. You don't really know what's happening. I think someone who has to be really, you know, safe in Kashmir should not use the cell phone, should not be on the internet, should use, I think, the letters, the old way. That's much better. And I think we do it sometimes. We're like, let's just meet and talk face to face rather than talking on the phone.
Yeah, just a short comment. I feel like there has been a lot of journalists, on at least on my Twitter feed, have been commenting on how Twitter has done a lot to, you know, mark Donald Trump's tweets that this is fake, but that doesn't happen in India at all. And this is what I think I was talking about. And with the whole slander thing, we know that, you know, our government, like Indian government, has a lot of like bot Twitters. Like, you know, no one knows who's behind those Twitter handles. And all they do is like target journalists or activists.
Yeah, in Brazil, like the Senate, not the Senate, but the lower house opened the investigation to see if the president is involved in a system we call here the Hatred Bureau, which is a fictitious place where they create these fake news, hatred message, and all the bots that create all this polarization and the social tensions.
We have seen a trend of journalists being intimidated. They're being harassed, they're being beaten up. I was personally beaten up once for doing a story while I was covering a spot in Srinagar. And I think it's very unfortunate, rather than reporting what's happening on the ground, given the situation, given the crisis here. Journalists are themselves
joke about it, that who would be the next to get summoned.
I think we just interviewed a hero of freedom, because it's very impressive. You're very brave. I mean, Brazil's kind of living as violent as Kashmir, but I mean, our president is totally anti-media and anti-journalist. So I follow some journalists on Twitter, Brazilian ones, and say they're every time harassed, and always somebody asking them to stop. And I mean, it's their job. If they don't talk, who else is gonna talk? So I mean, it's very important what you're doing. It's very impressive as well. I'm feeling very privileged to be part of this podcast, especially because of your presence. Seriously. I don't know what to say, because I mean, I'm very overwhelmed right now, because yeah, it's amazing. Thank you
for inviting me. I think it's very interesting that there are still some people out there who know that where Kashmir is, and they are interested in knowing what is happening there with the people. That's very interesting.